I think it's great on Mother's Day to have a song about Mary. And I read something really great that Thomas Merton wrote about Mary this week, and was just thinking he wrote it for Protestants, because I think that he rightly so knew our tendency to protest ourselves kind of to the opposite extreme. And I think that we oftentimes say nothing about Mary, and it's unfortunate. And I read this from him, and I just thought I would, at the start, in honor of Mother's Day, begin with this reminder of the mother of Jesus. And he writes, "Yet the Son of God, in emptying himself of his majestic power, having become a child, abandoning himself in complete dependence to the loving care of a human mother, in a certain sense draws our attention once again to her. The light has wished to remind us of the window, because he is grateful to her, and because he has an infinitely tender love. It is certainly a great grace and a privilege, and one of the most important aspects of this privilege is that it enables us, to some extent, to appreciate the mystery of God's great love and respect for his creatures." And I just want to begin by saying happy Mother's Day as well. Last year for Mother's Day, we were studying the book of Job, and we were at a particularly grisly passage. I think it was like pustules on Job. So we thought we'd lighten it up this year. We're just going to talk about the beheading of John the Baptist instead. We're going to be in Matthew 14, and it actually, there's just some really beautiful moments throughout this chapter. That's one little piece of it, but I'm going to, I think my hermeneutics professor would have a heart attack at this, but I'm going to go through and I'm going to give you three different little Mother's Day insights in this passage. Now, this is not a passage on mothers, but I think you see some beautiful little pictures of the heart of a mother that really shine in this chapter. And so I'm going to give you three of those little Easter eggs as we kind of go through. And in beginning, I'm actually going to backtrack. We're going to go back into just a few verses at the end of chapter 13. That are talking about a homecoming of Jesus's, where he returns to Nazareth, this little town where he was raised. They think that maybe at the time of Christ there was less than 1,000 people, maybe less than 500 people that lived and grew up in Nazareth. And so this tiny little hometown that Jesus returns to. Let me just begin with a word of prayer, and we'll go to our text. And Jesus, we thank you for this morning, God, for the mothers that are here, God, for the reminder of just how much love you have poured out on this world through them. And God, we say thank you to the mothers in our own lives. Jesus, I ask as we come to your text, Lord, that you would make it clear, God, that we would see truth, we would see greater truth. God, give us the eyes to see, the ears to hear. God, I pray for a special word for each one here. We pray this in your name. Amen. I had my own little homecoming last week. My younger sister got married, and I officiated the wedding, and which was kind of a crazy merging of all these circles, you know, when you get there. And you've got this table over here and this table over here, and I'm thinking, gosh, a lot of these people I haven't seen in over 20 years, and had a few people come up to me and go, "Wow, a pastor." And I was thinking, yeah, you know, the last you saw was like 17-year-old Jeff. But it's interesting how kind of hometown works, and memories, and how we kind of with family and with home, we can easily fall back into kind of who we were. I mean, I think about this every time I'm with my sisters that, I mean, my older sister, she's 2 years older, but she will always have the upper hand no matter what. I mean, when she says, Jeff, I'm like, yes, Carolyn. And my younger sister is always going to be my little sister, right? She's always going to stay just right there. I'm always going to be a middle child. Family stuff, those are like deep roots, right? It goes down deep into our identity. And because of that, I think that it is, because it's an identity thing, it matters just that much more. You know, so much of the rest of our lives are spent kind of really coming to grips with those formative years of our life. And here we see Jesus coming back into that world, a world that was very familiar, that knew not just him, all his brothers, all his sisters, his mom and his dad. And Jesus comes into the midst of that and begins to speak and receives, I think, probably one of the hardest wounds that he ever receives, which is the rejection of his family and his friends. And so we're going to begin there. If you would look with me to chapter 13 of Matthew, verse 53. It says, when Jesus had finished these parables, he went from there. And coming to his hometown, he taught them in their synagogue. So they were astonished and said, where did this man get his wisdom and these mighty works? Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And are not all these his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all these things? And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and in his own household. And he did not do many mighty works there because of their unbelief. This is kind of, there's a lot of little bits of information here. And as we kind of go through this chapter, just for the record, I'm going to kind of just shine a light at different spots as we're going through, if that sounds okay. It's interesting to see that somehow the belief and the faith of these people is connected to what Jesus is able to do. I mean, Mark says it even more dramatically than this. It says that he could not do miracles there. As if the hardness or the rejection of these people, of his friends and family, somehow stifled, it quenched, quashed the power. It's an interesting thing to see. That doesn't mean that Jesus couldn't somehow have maybe overruled that. I'm sure that he could. But yet, something about the way he works connects with the way people see, the way people understand, and the way they believe. When it says they took up an offense, it's getting a deep rejection that happens in their hearts. And they make the same mistake, same false conclusion that the Pharisees arrived at. See, the Pharisees, they looked at Jesus and they went, well, we disagree with his understanding of the law, so therefore the authority that he possesses must be, I mean, it's the power of demons. And really, his friends and family kind of come to the same conclusion. We're told elsewhere that his family even thinks he's insane. In one of the Gospels, it says they go to throw him off a cliff, which would have been like a mercy killing. They thought he had lost his mind. And this is kind of the conclusion that they come to based on the fact, hey, we knew this guy. We knew him when he was a little kid. He could not be doing these kind of, he could not be who he claims. And as they see the power, either they think he's insane or they think he's possessed. And they reject him. Now, I think that there's a couple things that we glean from this, but certainly I think that we can, we know that he's deeply wounded by this rejection. His brothers even, in fact, have rejected him, those closest to him. And you see something interesting here as they're talking about these brothers, you know, by name. We know that a couple of these guys at least make it. They, by the end, have seen and understood. James, for one, becomes one of the key leaders in the church. Judas, we think, wrote the book of Jude. And so these guys somehow in the end are able to understand. In fact, I think Paul says that Jesus appears to James after he's resurrected. Something that my little tidbit on Mother's Day here, by the way, it's interesting to see Mary in these instances. A few chapters ago, she came with his brothers, and we know the brothers were pushing against, but the question is, where is Mary in all of this? Where does she stand? And I thought, this is a little bit of speculation, but we know that Mary understands Jesus' calling. I mean, she's told by an angel. She understands who he is, even in seeing him in the synagogue talking before the religious leaders. She knows the calling that is on this man. And so Mary is there, I think, playing mediator. Mary is there as the peacekeeper. Mary is there holding the family together. And thinking about a little Mother's Day virtue here, I thought, isn't this like our moms? The ones that hold and pull all these kind of different strands together. I think of times when my sisters and I were at odds and my mom pulling us in and holding us, keeping the family, keeping the unity there, believing in each one of us. And anyway, I just think it's an interesting picture as we see Mary and we see the family here at work and the dissension there, the faithfulness of Mary to walk alongside her son. So there's Mother's Day virtue number one. Thank you, moms, for that. Jesus is going to make this interesting statement there at the end. He says, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and in his own household. And this sounds very much like Jesus is quoting some sort of familiar proverb, and I think this is probably true. But Jesus is also making a title claim there as he says this. He refers to himself as prophet. And while we know that Jesus is not reduced down simply to that role, this is an important title that he bears. Jesus is not just prophet, but priest and king. And yet he is prophet. He speaks with the authority, with the voice of God. And as Jesus mentions that, we're going to see as we kind of segue into our next chapter, ways that he fulfills that role, not just in the shoes of the Old Testament prophets, but in a new way. With an even greater authority, with a greater power, and with kind of new definition as he kind of expands that understanding. The last of the Old Testament prophets here, we have kind of a flashback into the death of John. And the death of John is going to mark the conclusion of these Old Testament prophets. So if you'd read with me, let's go to 14, verse 1, and we'll read through 12. It says, at that time, Herod, the tetrarch, heard about the fame of Jesus. And he said to his servants, this is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him. And then we have a little flashback here. It says, for Herod had seized John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, who is now actually Herod's wife, since he divorced his and took his brother's wife. Because John had been saying to him, it is not lawful for you to have her. She wasn't just his brother's wife, by the way. She was also his niece. And though he wanted to put him to death, he feared the people because they had held him, John, to be a prophet. But when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before the company and pleased Herod, so that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. Prompted by her mother, she said, give me the head of John the Baptist here on a platter. And the king was sorry, but because of his oath and his guests, he commanded it to be given. He sent and had John beheaded in prison, and the head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. And his disciples came and took the body and buried it, and they went and told Jesus. Now, this is a very grisly. This is like straight out of a soap opera or something like that, or worse, I guess. Very barbaric. But John, you see here, outspoken against Jesus. I love this fact. You know, you go, okay, why is this in here? And it is. It's marking a change. There's a, we're going to see Jesus again entering into kind of a next phase of his ministry at the death of his cousin John. But I think part of the reason this is in here is because it just, this is what happened. I mean, you can go read Josephus, who is a Jewish historian, and he lists these very same details. And some of that just gives us a beautiful sort of a compliment to the authenticity of the scriptures. As we read through it, we go, it's just another indication of the trustworthiness of these stories, that they're accurate. Herod, the Tetrarch, there was actually three Herods at the time. That's the idea of Tetrarch. And they basically, the Roman government had said, we're going to take Herod the Great's three sons and we're going to split them up, divide the kingdom, and each of them kind of have a little piece of it that they rule. And this is Herod Antipas that is the one who stole his half-brother's wife. And she obviously, Herodias, was a very severe, we might even say kind of evil woman. She is kind of a Jezebel, right? And you get in this picture kind of some allusions to some of the, you know, it sounds a little bit like the book of Esther. It sounds a little bit like Jezebel and Elijah here. But she had this vindictive desire to see John die for the things he was saying about her. We're told that Herod Antipas actually sticks John in prison to kind of protect John from his wife, because Herod was so afraid of what was going to happen to his reputation if he killed a prophet. So anyways, his little scheme, her scheme, goes successful, and John is killed, and Jesus receives this news. It's interesting, it starts out that Herod is looking at Jesus now, and we see Herod's suspicion of Jesus growing. In fact, he's thinking that this is John's ghost come back to haunt him. And so you see actually probably kind of how his mind has been influenced by some of the different pagan ideas of the time. But as Jesus hears this news, he withdraws. As he sees Herod in this kind of looming monster, you know, the opposition towards Jesus is growing and growing. Now we're beyond Pharisees into the king himself coming after. We're going to see Jesus withdraw from that. He's going to end up leaving Galilee and going somewhere that's going to end up being a little bit safer for him. And so in verse 13, it says, now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. Now when it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place, and the day is now over. Send the crowds away to go to the villages and buy food for themselves. But Jesus said, they need not go away. You give them something to eat. They said to him, we have only five loaves here and two fish. And he said, bring them here to me. Then he ordered the crowds to sit on the grass. And taking the five loaves and the two fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing. Then he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. And they all ate and were satisfied, and they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces left over. And those who ate were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. This is maybe in some ways the most famous miracle that Jesus ever does. It's the one that is actually the only miracle that's in all four Gospels. Did you know that? The feeding of the 5,000, which we learned from Matthew's Gospel was actually probably the feeding of the 10,000, because it turns out it's 5,000 men, not just 5,000 people. And here's kind of the Mother's Day virtue number two. I love this, that Jesus, his heart is broken. This looming opposition is growing. He's experienced the death of his beloved friend John. He's experienced rejection from his family. All this political scandal is coming against. He withdraws. If anybody deserves some time to himself right now, it's Jesus. And as he goes, all these people follow, like tugging on his robe. Jesus, Jesus. Can you heal my friend? Can you heal me? Can you cure this illness that I'm experiencing? And Jesus, as he turns around, this to me is just so motherly. It says his heart is filled with compassion. And, you know, I can't help but think he must have looked at them like his kids. And I think about moms, and I think about how you guys do this. You guys love when you're totally empty, when your tank is totally depleted and it's the end of that day and that little 3-year-old's tugging on your leg saying, Mom, can I have a snack? whatever that is, I think this is a beautiful virtue of a mom, and something that you deserve to be told thanks for. And you see this as a very Christ-like attitude as well. This idea of when he's gone to this place to recover his strength, still finds that he has more to give. And Jesus has gone back, and I think he's asking himself this question during this time. What does this mean? John is gone. The one paving the way for him has left. And it's just him. And we're going to see Jesus step in to the midst of these crowds and host a meal for them. These people are not starving, first off, right? That they're there and they're hungry and they're gathered, a lot of people. But this ends up becoming like the Lord's Supper the first time, and it hasn't gained all its significance yet. It's the very beginning of this, and yet you see Jesus breaking bread and passing it out to feed the multitudes. Now, this isn't the first time this has been done. Does anybody know an Old Testament prophet that broke bread and then multiplied it? This is worth big points if you get it right. Anyone? Not Ezekiel. It starts with an E, though. Not Elijah. Elisha. Elisha takes 20 loaves and feeds 100 with it. And there was leftovers. And this is like all this stuff. I mean, I love this about these things. I love how subtle in the Hebrew literature these little pointers are. Rather than spell that out, you get these like little hints, right? They're like, again, like Easter eggs, little things to find. But this miracle has been done. And as Jesus says there at the start, as he refers to himself as a prophet in Nazareth, all of a sudden we start to see what kind of a prophet. And he's, again, making connections to these Old Testament guys, to Elisha. But what we see is Elisha multiplied those loaves by 5, Jesus by 1,000. And they wouldn't have missed that, right? That we're seeing that same sort of power, that same sort of authority, that same anointing on Christ. And yet the multiplication of this is many times over. I love how there's baskets, 12 baskets at the end. Somebody was smart enough to catch that. Hey, 12 baskets. And what we see is a different sort of authority also in Jesus' this claim. As he breaks this bread and he serves it to the people, we think of God providing the manna in the desert. We see of an authority on Jesus like a Moses sort of figure leading his people from captivity. And as this bread is passed out and broken and multiplied, we see Jesus stepping into that role of the great liberator, the one providing that way out of slavery and out of bondage. I love how there's manna left over this time, because that's never really worked in the past. You never were allowed to store it up. It would go bad the next day, except the night before. You could save it before the Sabbath, and it lasted, but otherwise it was full of worms. But here we have leftovers, and it's an interesting picture. The abundance of God working, that God's grace is poured out not just to fulfill and satisfy the need, but in abundance. And you see Jesus telling his disciples, gather that stuff up. A great little picture there of our calling. Because as they come to him and say, what are we going to do about food? Jesus says, you feed them, you guys. And so here we start to see a new shift in the calling of the disciples, as they're following and asking this question, who is this guy? As they're understanding the authority and the power that he possesses, Jesus starts going, you do it. You get out there and do it. And so they do. They begin taking this, and you could imagine kind of their eyes in amazement as they see Jesus taking the limited resources and multiplying them many times over. If Jesus did this today, it probably would have been like a Lunchable. I mean, this was like this little boy's food, and he just goes, all right, that's enough to work with. We'll start with that. And so everybody's getting this multiplied Lunchable that just keeps getting passed out. But it really is as simple as that. Jesus providing a meal. It's interesting that we start this chapter with Herod giving his birthday banquet, and then we see this contrasted with Jesus offering a completely different sort of feast, completely different sort of banquet. A banquet that in many ways is very modest, and yet you see the depth of what is being given here. I was reading through these Hebrew prayers and came across one, a prayer of thankfulness for the bread. And I think it's probably what Jesus prayed. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who brings forth the bread from the earth. I love how he looks up to the sky. It's a posture of reverence, but this sense of Jesus communing with the Father, giving thanks for the simplicity of this gift. John tells us that the people see this and their response is, this is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. And this is exactly right. Interestingly enough, I think the disciples miss it. We don't see that in Matthew. Matthew kind of gives us the abbreviated version, but Mark tells us the disciples left there and they still hadn't figured it out. But they're going to get it here in just a second. In verse 22... it says, immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone, but the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, it is a ghost. And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid. And Peter answered him, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. He said, come. So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshipped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. This is, if any of you have been going to Sunday school since childhood, this is a story you've heard many times, I'm sure. Both of these examples are classics. It is a wonderful story, and I think that there's a lot that we can glean from this one as well that applies. Jesus finally gets the time off that he needed. He catches a break. He sends the disciples away even at this point, like, you guys get out of here. He gets his time to pray. They head out into this storm, and this storm is severe. In fact, where it says the wind was against them, that almost means like in a supernatural, cosmic sort of way. You know, this is just pure speculation, but I wonder if Jesus was just giving himself a little bit more time. And so he just kind of stirred it up. So they're out there rowing and rowing and rowing and rowing. And he's like, don't worry, I'll catch up with you guys. They're out there and they're at the end of their strength, rowing and rowing and rowing against this storm. Jesus comes out, and, you know, I think one of the things that is just so beautiful about this picture is the calmness of this. Jesus, in this case, doesn't still the storm. Do you notice that? He could. We've already seen him do it. Jesus instead just walks right out into the midst of it. They would be a few miles out, and you see him just kind of pacing. They're there rowing, and he's gaining on them as he walks out onto the sea. And Jesus comes out. It's interesting, the disciples' response is a little bit like Herod's. You know, as Herod's seeing Jesus, he's thinking, oh no, this is John the Baptist, come back to haunt me. Well, here the disciples are seeing Jesus, and they think, it's a ghost. It's maybe the ghost of Jesus. And I think that's in there to show us still that level of unbelief. They haven't grasped some things, some bits of knowledge about who God is. And so it takes a little bit of convincing, but sure enough, Peter comes to understand and decides, I want to get out of the boat. Now, what would possess Peter to want to get out of the boat? why don't they just let Jesus get into the boat, right? But it's an interesting thing when Jesus is going around saying, follow me, he means something very specific. This would be like getting your admittance letter to a college. It means that you had made it, you had made the grade. All the disciples are dropouts, right? But they hadn't made the grade. But those that had would go on to higher education, and those that really excelled might have the opportunity to follow in the footsteps of a rabbi. And so they would go and sort of candidate for this great honor. But the rabbi wouldn't invite them to follow him unless he thought they had what it takes. And so when Jesus said that to Matthew, the tax collector, you could imagine how in shock Matthew would have been, how in shock everybody around that in that situation would have been. As Jesus looks at these fishermen and he goes, you have what it takes to be like me. But you hear Peter going, all right, then I want to walk on the water. Isn't that great? Like, okay, you're saying that I can follow in your footsteps? I want to go out there then. And I think Jesus is saying, exactly, Peter, exactly, right? You do it. He hands them the bread and he says, you feed them. And here, as Peter's looking at Jesus, he's going, I want to walk. And he's going, okay, now you're understanding. I'm not looking for people that are going to obey a set of rules. I'm looking for people that are a particular type of person, right? A new creation. And Jesus is inviting all of us to this discipleship, right? But it's told that what he does is he comes in and makes us whole. He comes in and makes us a certain type of person. It's a new humanity that Jesus creates. But it involves us putting on Christ. It involves us being like our rabbi. And Peter steps out of the boat, and he does pretty good for a while, and then he sinks. And again, like when we look back, we see the hard-heartedness of the family and the way that that is preventative to the working of miracles. And this is an interesting thing about how God works. There's a respecter of human will in him to where he doesn't just override. And you see the same sort of thing here with Peter. And this is something important for us to learn, that when he takes his eyes off of Jesus and becomes fearful of him, of his circumstances, he really does physically start to sink. That the danger that's there when it's reduced down to his circumstances, when he gets overwhelmed by it, all of a sudden it starts to work against him. And he cries out to Jesus, and Jesus catches his hand, helps him into the boat. I wonder if the disciples would kind of make fun of Peter for this later, although I think probably deep down they all wished they had gotten out of the boat too. I wonder if after this, if Peter and Jesus ever went out and like practiced. Like, okay, let's try that again. Can I try that again? I'll do better this time. In both of these miracles, you get that Jesus is exposing them to a greater reality, right? And there's this lack of faith, and sometimes, you know, you could, I think, wrongfully assume that they're being too logical here, right? That it's logic that tells us, well, you can't produce bread, you can't, you know, you can't multiply bread. It's logic that tells us you can't walk on water. But it's interesting. I've been with a friend. We've been going back through. Anybody take a logic class in college? You know, I mean, this is like one of the classic, these are classic fallacies of logic to believe, well, I've never seen that before, so that means it cannot happen. This is just the fallacy of hasty generalization, right? It's a really easy one for us to make. It seems so common sense and so logical, but it's actually bad thinking. And you come to these conclusions about what God can do because I've never seen that happen before. But God is saying, have faith, right? Why? Because reality is greater than what we've limited it to. And just like Jesus' family and these people that have become so familiar, it's limited our field of vision to where we can't see the way things really are. And so we start operating based on our limited resources, and we start functioning within the context of immediate appearances. And I think Jesus is trying to get us to break these two things. Not just when things go bad, although that might be a good place to start, right? And when all of a sudden we are at our wit's end and everything goes wrong, I think it is easy, like Peter, at times to cry out, Lord, help me, right? But I think just even in the simplicity of this meal, as Jesus is feeding the 5,000, he's saying, I'm not limited by time and space, right? And I'm not afraid of the storm. I don't need to stop the storm to be safe, right? Sometimes I think that we so often are praying for the storm to go away. And Jesus is saying, you need to be praying that you can walk on water, right? That's the right response. In the midst of it, the peace in the midst of it is what Jesus wants for us. He's going, life is going to be hard. John the Baptist still, unfortunately, gets his head chopped off here, right? That there is like a grisly reality at times to life, but Jesus is saying, don't worry. In this world, you'll have trouble, but take heart. I've overcome the world. So as we face the circumstances and all of that, we're not sitting there clutching to our loaves and fish. We're giving those generously to God, saying, do whatever you will with it. Jesus' response, Peter's saying, is it you, Lord, is it you? And Jesus' response, take heart, it is I. And this, it is I, is also translated as I am. This is the tetragrammaton, the name of God. And this is really powerful. It's no surprise that at this point they come to this conclusion, truly you are the Son of God. I wonder what happened when he said that. There's a wonderful psalm, Psalm 77. And listen to these words. I got to imagine that it was something like this. It says, when the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters. Yet your footprints were unseen. And I love that picture of just the mightiness of God. That out there, just unaffected, calm and at peace, you see the greatness of this God. It's no wonder that Peter wanted out there, right? That's where you want to be. I think there's another little Mother's Day Easter egg right here. You know, I was thinking about Jesus and Peter in this. And I think Jesus must have felt extremely proud of Peter in just desiring to get out of the boat. And this is something, you know, I thought maybe, my mom's coming this afternoon, but I thought maybe she was going to make it down to the service this morning. But I just remember this one moment with my mom. I was kind of going through this interesting transition in life, kind of a rite of passage thing. As I was finishing up grad school, I found myself in conflict with a couple of my professors, guys that I really respected, but I thought, I think these guys are wrong, which is like, it's a really hard thing to say your professors are wrong, right? These are like the authority. And so I was kind of had my own inner struggle. And when I started doing my dissertation for my doctorate, I was pushing out away from these guys, and it was kind of unnerving for me. And again, I think that was ended up being a really healthy thing, but it shook my confidence. And I remember as I was writing this, I was struggling, and my mom said to me, Jeff, just punch it as hard as you can. And it was like exactly what I needed, right? It was just so liberating. My mom just going like, Jeff, just go for it. And it like totally helped me break through on that. And I thought just that belief, my mom just, she just believes in me and always has. And I love that about a mom. I think that's very Christ-like, but I think that's also a very motherly gift. I think that you moms do that. You believe so wholeheartedly in your children. I hope you do. I know you do. But I love that here, the sweetness of this relationship between Jesus and Peter. I think that must be why, in many ways, Jesus says, I'm going to build my church on you, Peter. Impulsive Peter, for shooting from the hip, Peter, the guy who always kind of goes off. Yet Jesus has just got such a soft spot for him. We're called to be like that. We're called to function in this kind of new sort of reality with an openness to what God is doing, with a reliance on His supply, His provision, not intimidated by the circumstances. I was reading this week and I loved this. A friend of mine shared it with me. It's from Dallas Willard, who's just a brilliant philosophy professor from USC. He's also a great Christian man. Is at this academic conference, and he's asked to prepare to write a paper on how do you get tenure at USC. And so you could imagine, you know, what's the strategy? What's kind of the angle, Dallas? How did you get there? And he begins by saying, well, first off, I didn't even apply for the job. Some guy just called me up and asked me if I wanted the job, and I said yes. He said, I just was sort of interested in philosophy and started writing. And he says this. Well, I mean, just listen to the modesty of this. He says, I decided I would do nothing trying to secure myself or gain advancement. I am very much a literalist in terms of the Bible. This is to all these academics. He says, the Bible says promotion does not come from the East or the West. It comes from the Lord. So, okay, I don't have to do anything about promotion. But what I did was this. I said, I'm going to do the best work I can by God's help. And that meant in writing and teaching. And once again, it wasn't that I was smart. The Lord just guided me. So I worked on papers, and my idea was that if it was any good, it would be able to be sent into the best journals where no one knew me, and it would be accepted. You should love that, kind of the modesty. Here's this guy. He's like, well, I really believe that the Bible is true, so I just kind of started doing what I felt God was doing and utilizing the gifts He's given me. So this next one, I love this. He says, so on to the next paper. My strategy was this. Do really good work. Do work that you would think God had to help you with to get you there. Then do some more. Just stay at it. That's the only strategy I've had, is to work in that way. My view is that if you are in a good field, you must work on the things that are really central and essential to that field. And you ought to believe that God will enable you to do work in that field, that it will be a benefit and a challenge to everyone. We want to get to the point where people scattered around, he's talking now to academics, he says, people scattered around the academic world are worried about what we are doing. They sit up at night and think about us. They get on the internet and they chase our work down. I really challenge you to believe that about yourself, whatever your area of work is, not because you are so good, but because God is so great. And, you know, thinking about this, each one of us as a disciple of Jesus has this simple mission, right? But how often our mission is reduced down to like, well, what do I got in my tool chest? What kind of wood do I have to build with? All right, we're going to set the plan and the vision around that, right? And God's saying, oh no, bigger. We need to go bigger than that, right? Because the thing is, the danger is when we function and we operate just on our own simple resources, man, when something big happens, where's the faith? We haven't seen it, right? I mean, I think this is the power of like when Paul is talking to the Philippians and he says, here's the secret, in poverty or in prosperity, it's the same thing. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He's going, okay, really, like when you wake up each day, that's the plan, right? Like, okay, Jesus, what are we doing today? What is the plan? And when we go, well, here's what I have to bring, this loaf and fish, you don't realize that's it, that's all we've got. You instead go, what are we going to do with this, God? How do I apply myself to a vision that's bigger than what I can accomplish on my own? When we do that, then we start to see Him, right? Then we start to realize this isn't just some sort of illogical leap of faith. You start seeing the evidence of God and going, I couldn't have done this without Him. That the ideas that come, you go, that's not my idea. That's God speaking. And you start moving into that authority with confidence. You start to hear his voice, to recognize his voice, to see his presence. When you do that, all of a sudden you realize you can just completely relax. Whatever situation you're in, you're okay. Whatever circumstance you're in, you have exactly what you need, right? And so you come to God with that sort of inner strength and peace. This is the peace that surpasses understanding, because everybody else is looking at you going, you're nuts. Don't you see the world is crashing around you? And you go, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. On the flip side, apart from me, you can do nothing. Two mistakes we easily make. We limit the resources God has given us, and we see our immediate surroundings as the full story. I think God's telling us, like as disciples, to be faithful in the little things, right? And to see his hand in the daily things that he gives us, in the simple tasks. He's saying, find me in that. See my presence. Allow me to work in the details there. And so that when the storms of life come, we're unshakable. I want to just close us with a psalm that's, I think, probably a familiar one, but one that Patty and I have just really been enjoying in Psalm 46. It's called God is Our Fortress by the Sons of Korah. I'm just going to read the whole thing for you. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolations on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Amen.